Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
March 7th, 2016, episode number 91. Don't believe in everything you think. Hi everyone, Kevin England with you once again on the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. I think about this time of year being one of my favorite times of year as we lead into spring. Not for the obvious aspect that beekeeping is coming in full bloom, pun intended, but because this is a time of year where I start to talk to a bunch of new prospective beekeepers and they get me excited about beekeeping again. The enthusiasm, the questions, the uncertainty, and the excitement of getting bees is infectious when you start to talk to others. And I really do enjoy this time of year. Last week we had a beekeepers meeting and I got to meet a lot of new people. And I told myself going into the meeting, just relax, enjoy the meeting, have fun in the presentations, and really listen and hear what people have to say. And I have to say, it's been one of the most enjoyable meetings I've had in a long time. So with that as my opening, let me go ahead and tell you what we have in store for this episode. For segment number one, we'll talk about mite biting behavior. Segment two, cloak boards, what they are and why you would want one, how you would use it. Only two segments for this episode. Roundtable, honeymoon, what does it mean? When did beekeeping begin for beekeepers? Roundtable number three, short little ditty on Dave Hackenberg, something I read, and I'm not really sure what to make of it. Roundtable number four, three hive styles to talk about that I've come across recently. And it continues to garner my fascination with different ideas of how a hive should look and work. Roundtable number five, health of honey. And a follow-up to this allergy thing that everybody thinks is going on when you're eating honey and why it's not plausible. And then, you know, maybe a couple other odds and ends. I want to talk about the meeting we had recently, some of the activities that have been keeping me away from the microphone, some of the activities that are coming up that may keep me away from the microphone. But, you know, I'm game to keep recording as much as I can get in here and get things going, so all right, time to get started. First thing, we'll go right into the local hive report. February 20th, I went and checked on my hives to see how they were all doing. Three hives, all good. That's a good news. Actually, they looked pretty strong and healthy. A testament to following a regime in the fall leads to strong bees in the spring. I opened the hives, looked at the size of the cluster, and then proceeded to put some pollen patties and some sugar blocks on them. I had two sugar blocks left over from previous seasons that I bought from Carly Toth to support him at a beekeeping meeting. And I had talked in the notion of a previous podcast of building my own pollen patties, but when I saw how inexpensive they were, I just purchased them. And I put them on all three of my hives. I have to say the strongest hive from what I could see was the polystyrene hive. No surprise from what I thought that would be. The interesting thing is when you open these hives, they were all very calm, even though it was a little cool that day, February 20th. And the bees all just came up looking between the frames and I did not get stung and none of them were buzzing me menacingly or any way, shape, or form. I did shoot a first hive inspection video. If you want to check that out, youtube.com/NWNJBA on that day. And I'm proud to say that my three hives look really good going into spring. From the local hive report standpoint, just recently we got a couple warm days And then it's been cool over the last 5-6 days. But in those warm days, the crocuses have popped up. So have the snowdrops in my yard. And the bees were all over pulling the pollen and nectar out of the crocuses. To me, that's the surefire you have made it to spring signal for our property is if they get to the crocuses, they will survive to the full-blown nectar flow. So pretty happy about that. And I spoke to Stan Wazatowski tonight, which I'll talk about a little later, and have two packages on order, and I plan to put those in my hives that are not conventional. I have a top bar hive that I want to put a package in, and I have a Ware hive that I want to put a package in. And as I've mentioned, my plan is to put those in and then somewhere in the late spring, but before the June dearth, I will probably replace the queens with some local queens that I think will do better in the long run. So not too much to report in the local hive report. I'm really looking forward to about that April 15th time frame to do some splits with my hives. And I have to go get some of my beekeeping equipment ready to put some more hives in and also swarm traps. Hopefully I'll catch some. Again, more on that later. So local hive report, 3 for 3. The one hive on the property looks strong, ready to go. And the two hives over the farm look pretty good too. And put a little food on them just to get them really going here for spring, because I want to be fat and happy for the time that we get to splits. Local hive report, check, all done. So I'm not messing around here tonight. It's a Monday night recording. I'm going to roll right into segment number one. This one's called Beating Varroa. I've been thinking about treatment-free and the prospect of where things are in a quest to conquer the problems of Varroa mites. Some in our area have tried no treatments and then gone back to some form of treatments because they just could not pull it off. And as I watch the treatment-free community with envy for clues, it starts to become clearer to me what some of the recipes are for success. And it ties into the title of this episode, which is Don't Believe Everything You Think. I think of a lot of things. I think you know I think of a lot of things. I allow myself the room to think different thoughts. And then in the end, I reconcile them and come up with what my real thoughts are on a matter, a topic, a notion. But I go through different periods of different thoughts. One session blended into a mix of other sessions that form my stream of consciousness about beekeeping. I don't consider myself different or unique. I just recognize the fact that I am a sum of my experiences. And I'm guessing if you are a regular listener, then you probably know that my thoughts are always evolving, and sometimes I don't believe everything I think. And my notion about treatment-free is meandering these days. I so wish to get there, and I so have received tons and tons of advice from people. But I also reconcile the fact that I've tried some radical things and it has not worked out for me, so I'm still trying to find my path. And for now, admittedly, I am going my own path to get to a more stable but conservative approach following common wisdom, something that I've spoken about in recent episodes. So my problem over the last few seasons has been a poverty of bees. With some treatments and feeding, I feel like I'm back on stable footing, but like so many, I'm seeking any possibility I can to be less treatment or simply treatment-free. Now, part of that is my lifestyle and having the ability to live that lifestyle, because it takes a lot to get there. And the more I watch and the more I learn, it becomes a recipe that gets someone to the finish line. That's my latest thought process. Much of what seems to work from what I've seen, takes an effort that requires at least you being a medium-scale beekeeper and leaves the hobbyist with 1 to 2 hives on the sideline. What I mean by that is my thought processes that are always running, as I said earlier, has summed up to me recently that it takes a village. You have to have selective queens. You have to do splits. You have to allow the bees to die if they are weak. You might take a mix or pinch of feral and or survivor stock. You might use Russian bees. You might use Varroa sensitive hygiene bees. And lately, you might consider the bees that are becoming the rock stars, the mite biting bees. And you might mix all of these things or some of these things. It's an interesting recipe that gets someone to be treatment free. And you can't forget my common notion that your environment is a byproduct of whether you can or can't do this. For the research shows, and anecdotally people say, that if you're in an area where people are treating or not treating Varroa or not Varroa, you're impacted by what is in your local vicinity because beekeeping is local, right? We say this all the time. So this segment was really about controlling Varroa, and I wanted to cover mite-biting bees. I'm going to put the treatment-free notion away. Let's go down this avenue. They've been in the news for a long time, but there's really not a ton of information out there about them other than they exist, and people are starting to use them. The Purdue crew has garnered a lot of attention with the moniker ankle-biting bees. And while it's a catchy name, you have to wonder if mites have ankles. It's just a little thing that rattles around in your head. We spoke of mite-biting bees back in episode 50 called Sticky Notes. And it's been a while, and some listeners have written in asking what the follow-up to this is. So either way, the premise of mite-biting bees is an interesting twist in the attack vector for bees against Varroa, and you have to wonder if this is a novelty or something that can be pervasive in the war. Is this something like high-end cars had backup cameras that trickled down to you can get it on a Nissan Sentra now? Are mite-biting bees going to be something that we can go to our local supplier and get? And on that notion, I've talked about this in passing, and the notion still passes, is that Russian bees came from an area where they learned to work with the mites that we're so plagued with. And there are people in the United States using Russian bees, and it's become a little more prevalent, but I can't go down to the local supplier and buy them, at least not in this region. I know I can order them from somewhere, but I just don't hear people doing that. In all of my association, I don't think, maybe if I asked around, I'd find one or two people doing this. So what about the mite-biting bees? Are we going to be able to buy those, source those at any given time when we want them? So let me not get ahead of myself, because I know that this time of year we have a lot of new beekeepers, and you might be wondering what all the fuss is about. Varroa destructor is enemy number one for bees, and perhaps you haven't heard about ankle-biting bees. So bees have a natural trait to groom themselves and each other, but somewhere along the way it was noted that mites on the bottom board were found to be missing legs when inspected under a microscope. And for beekeepers, the whole job in this world, in the last decade at least, has been how do you control the mites so they don't kill your colony? The term ankle biters seems like a Varroa-sensitive hygiene trait, also known as VSH, and some might consider these two the same, But my understanding is VSH is not the same. And it is more about bees that were known to identify mites in the cell and get them cleaned out by marking them for removal. So a VSHB, Varroa Sensitive Hygiene, would detect a mite, uncap the cell, and then the cell cleaners would come by, pull the larvae out and the mites, and get rid of them. This is not the same thing as the ones that are attacking mites. So I've known about this ankle biting trait for a long time. There was a pivotal video posted online at some point of a researcher introducing a mite to a hive and having it be attacked by a bee. If you've seen this video, you probably remember it as is. It was posted and there was this huge cheer all over the internet of people who just loved to see that. But going back to when I remember from episode 50 was there was a video released from a meeting that took place in Indiana, somewhere in the Midwest. I'm pretty sure it was Indiana. And it was a funny setting. Like, you see this guy standing behind a folding table, and he's in a garage. There's garage doors in the back, and there's equipment all over the place. It almost looked like a workshop. I'm not sure what it was. And I believe it was the Southwest Indiana Beekeepers Association. And it was Greg Hunt from Purdue. At least that's who I think it was. Could have fact-checked this a little bit. Forgive me for recording on a Monday night. Didn't get that organized about this. So this is the game plan for that line of bees that was talked about back then. These bees express the mite-biting characteristic through a dominant genetic characteristic that they have. And breed is the game plan for them. And to that end, listener Joseph Lewis sent an inquiry recently about this topic, and he was one of the ones that forwarded me some links about the topic and asked for the follow-up. I only have a limited knowledge of the topic because it seems to be centered around the Midwest, the news about this and the operations, and it hasn't made its way out here to New Jersey yet. But the key news about what I see being reported out of the region is that the bees can pass on this characteristic simply by being in your neighborhood and spreading the genetics. And the more they breed with other bees, the more this trait can get out into the landscape. I'm all for that. I'm really digging that idea. So Joe shared a link to a SARE grant that is working through the Heartland Honeybee Breeders Co-op. And they are testing ankle biters through Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Indiana. It seems in this SARE grant study program that they're monitoring 35 colonies across the region and found that, quote, mite biting behavior negatively inversely correlates to mite drops / populations, and Purdue MBB genetic parentage positively correlates to MBB percentages, end quote. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it was pivotal to what they were reporting. I'm taking it to mean that more work is needed in this, and you need to understand why by reading the report. In essence, it's hard for them to figure it out because the correlation of the impact to the mites in these colonies is hard to discern when other variables are at play. So think about it this way, just the complexity of a honeybee colony. More bees in this colony versus that colony means more mite populations. Healthier colonies mean more foragers. And one thing that they noted is that the healthy colonies that survived visit the dead colonies and inadvertently bring back mites for their troubles. So you think they're doing a great job, biting the mites, doing whatever, and then they go out and they get themselves infected and bring it back. If you're running a study, how do you do the math and the correlation of which mite was there? And it's not like you could tell this one arrived yesterday. So in the body of the study, there were a few interesting observations, such as mite populations skyrocket in August through October, and the bees in these colonies responded by biting more mites. Another factor that they probably weren't expecting and didn't understand how to work into the calculation. That's my notions on this. Another thing observed is they found a pile of mites dead near the entrances of the colonies. Isn't that interesting? The research paper speculates that perhaps the bees were grooming returning bees at the entrance that were returning from robbing out collapsed hives in the area. Man, what a service that is. I'd love to have my bees sitting at the entrance picking off the mites before they even got in and could make this huge population of mites inside my hives. That's a characteristic I'd really like to see. So on the other side of the observational stuff, just things that they noticed, winter survivorship and honey yields were higher with the colonies that had these bees. They worked with three groups of bees, and the average loss between the three was about 12.5% loss overall. And that, to me, sounds far better to the 30 to 60% averages that we've been hearing over the past few years, depending on whose stats you follow. Now, I said a moment ago that bees had a higher yield. They didn't measure this, but their comments were that these colonies seemed to produce more honey than the control hives used in the research. And I'll hearken that back to the notion that healthier bees do better. Healthier bees, better nutrition, more forage, better resources, stronger colonies. So the question looms with these ankle-biting bees. Is this the beginning of something big or just another tool in the battle to get an even playing field for Varroa destructor? I'll go back to the opening and say that it appears treatment-free is not formulaic. But sometimes you could do the math to find the right combination for an area. Like the CCD problem being a combination of stressors, the battle against Varroa could be the simple math of good nutrition plus genetic traits VHS, VSH, and mite biting, plus bee races like Russians who can deal with Varroa, plus splits to lessen the load and break the brood cycle, plus natural culling methods, plus perhaps a heat-like situation we discussed in our last episode, plus fixing the health problem as a result of the pesticides out in nature by getting them banned or changing the way they're used and applied, plus perhaps advances in hive technologies and anything else that I've left out of the formula. I think you've had enough pluses by now. All of these may be the calculation that adds up to winning the battle over mites, or better said, allowing our bees to live in a world where mites are part of the ecosystem. Because I don't think we'll ever win the battle simply by using a pesticide to kill a bug on a bug, or some magic mite treatment. I also think it will take time, but even without the interventions of mite biting and all these other things, bees will adapt and overcome. They have been on this earth since the Cretaceous period, some 75 to 150 million years ago, depending on who you listen to. So I think they're going to get by this. I have to thank Joseph for writing in on this. I've been meaning to come back and cover this for a while, and his notes reminded me that this was overdue. A side note, Joseph wanted to listen to an audio recording from Greg Hunt, the Purdue researcher associated for ankle biter bees, that was linked to in episode 50. That link was broken, and it appears that the ABF, American Beekeepers Federation, moved their archives around a bit. They had a recording of Greg Hunt talking about that. I fixed that link in the show notes for episode 50 if you're interested. And for your convenience, I posted it again with the show notes so you can listen to the MP3 for this episode. For a look at the videos that I mentioned and information about the Sarah Grant research paper view, our show notes at www.bkcorner.org. Click on the show notes and visit show number 91. You'll find the one-linked ankle biter video, Sarah study on Heartland Bee Breeders Co-op, Greg Hunt ABF talks on bees that bite mites. Might as well say, too, that if you're interested to write in, since I'm giving out contact information, you can write me, say hello, complain, criticize, good job, whatever you want to say, kevin@bkcorner.org, and I'll give one other plug, www.youtube.com/nwnjba is a video website that has a lot of content out there. Posted quite a few things since our last episode, and you can go check that out too. Segment number two, the cloak board method. I mentioned the cloak board method of raising queens in the past episode with a note to come back to it. This system of raising queens was invented by Harry Cloak in the late 70s and involves a use of a special board that is placed between two hive bodies, and the system encourages the hive body without a queen to become a cell-building colony upon placement of grafted larvae. So I'm going to explain how this system works, and it's divided into a set of activities that you perform over a number of days. Before I swing into trying to describe this, let me give you an idea about what a cloak board is, the piece of equipment proper. The simplest way to think about it is that it is a queen excluder with add-ons. If you took a queen excluder and built a rim around one side of it and provided a slot where you could slide a flat piece of material to cover up the queen excluder holes that you have, then you have the basic premise. The slide-in material is pretty similar to the slide-in tray you see in a screen bottom board design. So the rim that I mentioned when I talk about putting it on one side, it's on one side of the flat part, not just the long side or the short side. Does that make sense? How about this? The rim is three sides, the two long sides and the back of the queen excluder. It trims around the outside. It's very similar to like an Imry shim with one side missing. Okay, I think I killed the description. If you put this thing on a hive body, three of the sides are closed underneath the queen excluder and the one is open. And that opening becomes the device floor for the hive and the opening for the one on the above, right? So it's the cover for the one on the below, and yeah, I'll get to it in a minute. As I explain the method, it'll become more evident. So let's go ahead and talk about the method. First things first, you need a strong, healthy colony. Like any aspect of queen rearing, especially when you're going to try and get bees to finish grafted queens for you, you want a large, healthy colony with different age bees, and you want it to be well-fed and have plenty of nutrition so it can raise plump, healthy queens. In our last episode, we talked about forage and especially pollen leading to really strong, healthy larvae. Same could be said when you're trying to build queens. So the first step is to divide your colony, which is in several deep boxes, with the cloak board several days before this graft is going to be ready for you to put into the hive. You would want to put the board in as a queen excluder without the slide tray in so the bees can go between the boxes top to bottom. You want to ensure before you split the hive in half with a queen excluder, that you have brood cells in the bottom, below the queen excluder, and above it, so that nurse bees will be in both of the boxes. And ideally, you'd want to try and put as much brood in the top part so the nurse bees are encouraged to be above the queen excluder. And of course, the bottom and the top boxes should have stores of pollen, honey, and brood. Now, when the boxes get loaded, you will switch the hive 180 degrees so the entrance is in the back and you will close it up. Let me say that again. I'm splitting the hive in half. I'm putting this cloak board in the middle and I'm taking the bottom box sitting on the bottom board and I'm switching it around so the entrance is out the back and I'm closing it off. Got that? Okay. And just to be clear, crystal clear, the sliding tray is not in at this time. So a couple of points what happens at this stage. It's expected that the top will be the queen cell builder, so you would naturally confine the queen to the bottom of the hive below the excluder. And since we closed it off, it was important that you left her with stores, brood, and resources so she'll be fine down there to keep her operation going. So mind you, the hive bodies are sitting on top of each other, and the bees can be in contact with each other through the queen excluder, and everybody but the queen can pass through the two boxes, three boxes, whatever you have, and the back entrance is closed. And what will happen is, remember our cloak board is three-sided, so the cloak board provides the new entrance to the hive, and you face that towards the front. So bees that want to come and go will come up through the bottom box and out through the queen excluder and out through the entrance where the rim is only three-sided. Now what I tried to explain earlier is probably more evident. Now some of the bees are going to stay in the bottom box even though there is an entrance. And the day before you are ready to insert your grafted bees into the top of the hive, you will open the back entrance. Those bees that remain there will fly out and presumably go out and do whatever they're going to do. And then when they come back, they'll come to the front of the hive and they'll see the entrance and they'll enter the top box. This is on purpose. And the whole point of this is that hopefully they'll stay in the top box and you'll have the largest amount of bees in the top box. So now you're almost ready to do it. You're going to take a couple more short actions and then you're going to put your grafts in. You're going to go in your hive and look in the top part in case they built any queen cells and you'll remove them. You'll also want to remove any uncapped young larvae. You want the nurse bees to be in there, but you want them to be idle. And while you're doing that, you're going to slide the floor in and prevent the bees in the top box from going down. So you're trapping the nurse bees in the top when you slide the floor and they can't pass back through. And you're taking all of the brood, young brood, out, which gets them unemployed. Now, on this day that you're getting started, you'll open the colony without smoke and gently insert the grafted cells. Gently, because you don't want to rattle them around in there and damage any of your potential queens. And then you're going to close things up and you're going to leave them be for one day to get used to those grafted cells. On day two, your cells should have been accepted and you can remove the slide. And at the same time, you would close the rear entrance so that the cloak board becomes the entrance to the hive. You're going to let the hive operate for a few days, and during that, they will cap your grafted larvae, and that should take about 4 to 5 days. At this stage, you could pull them out and finish them off in the incubator colony somewhere else. Now, the fun thing here is you can keep things going by rotating the brood from the bottom to the top box, and start all over again, if you're so inclined, by repeating the process and adding more grafted cells. Now, if you think about it, you've taken your grafted capped cells and you put them in an incubator colony. On day 10 or 11 from when you started those graftings, you can pull your capped queen cells out from your incubators one by one and place them in donor colonies, and they should start to emerge in short order. So that's the basic premise of a cloak board, as I understand it, how to use it. And I've read pros or cons on this method prior to coming to this topic. It's, again, one of those topics I've always wanted to cover, and I've never tried it myself. I mentioned in the last episode I never could get into this grafting thing, but I will try it someday, and maybe this is an approach I'll do. I can't help but think, and have seen literature to back this up, that instead of putting grafted cells inside that top box, you could close it off and leave young larvae with, you could leave frames with eggs that are just new or a day or so old, and the queens will be raised by the colony, because with the separator in, they're going to think they're queenless. This way you wouldn't have to go through the trouble of grafting. It might take longer for you to build queens, but they will build queens for you. I guess if I think about it this way, I'm not sure what the premise of that would be. If you left the hives open, the foragers might fly back to the mother colony in the bottom and do whatever. Why not just make a walkaway split and take your top box and put it off in a yard somewhere else, away from the colony, so that it maintains its bees and let them raise their own queens? But you could potentially do it right there on the box with a cloak board and create the same situation. So hopefully I've done some justice in describing this. This method has been around since the late 70s, and there are a handful of articles out there that describe the method. I sourced the info I shared with you from a few websites and an article from a 2010 Bee Culture on how to make a cloak board. I have that right next to me. Let me see what episode. April 2010 was the episode. So in the show notes, I'll provide a link written up by Sue Coby, who's a renowned queen producer. This instruction set that she provides is hosted on the Three Rivers Beekeepers website, and it's probably the most comprehensive one I've found, and has a number of references in the bottom back to the original articles, including the Epimondia article that Henry Cloak wrote in 1977 when this was explained. And it's been covered a couple times in different journals and so on. So again, this is a fairly well-known approach. If you really wanted to see a cloak board, I know that they sell them both through Brushy Mountain and Kelly Beekeeping Supply, so you can go to their website and look them up to see what they look like, or just go to your favorite search website in images and type cloak board. You'll find plenty of information on what they look like and how to use one. So those are the segments I had prepared. Let's go to the back of the book. We call this the round table. It's just a smattering of different topics. First one probably could have been a segment. It's the origin of the word honeymoon. Most of us think about the traditional explanation of what it is. The definition says a period of harmony between two individuals following a marriage. Now, the interesting thing about that definition is that did not give a time reference, but there is a time reference in the history of this word. The etymology of the word comes from Old English honey, H-O-N-Y, moon, M-O-O-N-E. Honey refers to a reference of honey, as we think, which is associated with an indefinite period of tenderness and pleasure experienced by a newlywed couple, and how sweet the new marriage is. Moon, M-O-O-N-E, from Old English, refers to the fleeting amount of time that sweetness would last. So how's this for an interesting twist? Honeymoon had a negative connotation in its beginning. It had to do with the sweetness would not last very long. How's that? And I guess if you think about it, the honeymoon period, when it's used sometimes as the honeymoon period is over, that connotation still carries to today. But most of us think fondly about the word honeymoon and consider it a period of unusual harmony, especially following a new relationship, time with a new vehicle, an object of lust, things like that. I don't mean lust in a bad way. I mean things that you have coveted. So there's other things about this. Honeymoon has its origins back to the 5th century. And back then, a newlywed couple drank mead, which of course is honey, quote-unquote, wine, during their first moon of marriage. And mead is a honey-based alcohol drink believed to have aphrodisiac properties. So I was listening to one of my new favorite podcasts called Gastropod, and they were talking about aphrodisiacs and how many things are considered aphrodisiacs, but sweeteners, including chocolate, came in, and they were saying that chocolate actually has characteristics that make you put you in the mood, shall we say. But in that discussion, honey was always referred to and is often associated with fertility in weddings. And therefore, honeymoon comes with a connotation that honey will bring you good luck in that aspect also. So to that end, weddings once commonly took place upon the summer solstice. And it was at this time of year that honey was first harvested. And the drink, mead, supposedly increased virility and fertility, and therefore the first month of marriage became a honeymoon. So how about that? Always neat to learn about these things in our past and how they're still used today and how they change over time. So honeymoon, now you can have that conversation with other beekeepers and let them know what you learned. Roundtable number 2, beekeeping began 8,500 years ago. This one comes from the website archaeology.org. News was released. This particular article was sourced November 11, 2015. I've had it in my queue and just finally getting to it. In Bristol, England, they say chemical analysis of the Neolithic pottery vessels from more than 150 archaeological sites in Europe has detected the presence of beeswax for the first time. Prehistoric rock art images and murals from ancient Egypt have suggested that early farmers kept bees, but this is the earliest possible evidence of beekeeping found to date. So what they're saying is they've looked at pottery samples, and I read that word for word from the website, but now I'm saying that they've read this, or they've read these signs from archaeological sites, and they're finding that early farmers used honeybees in some way because they were using beeswax and honey possibly, and this is substantially earlier than what they believed in the past. So that's pretty cool. You could visit the website at archaeology.org, and we'll have a link to that article in our show notes. Roundtable number 3. This one's about an article that popped up on the web, and it's been posted around, and I was hesitant to post it out here, but I'm going to mention it just because I thought it was important to share. This was sourced from honeycolony.com. And the title is a bit sensationalistic. CCD poster boy David Hackenberg loses 90% of his beehives. It was posted January 21st of this year. Now, David Hackenberg, if you're not familiar with him, is a beekeeper who was in a movie about CCD that was very popular. And he is the one that was associated with colony collapse disorder and bringing the attention to the national scene due to his losses of colony collapse disorder infested plagued hives. That was back in 2006. And now what they're saying is, according to his son, who's running the business, he has lost 90% of his hives this winter. I can't imagine that this is not true if it's being reported this way. And it literally quotes Davey Hackenberg, who I met at an ES conference. And I've met Dave Hackenberg. And it says they're not driving across country to Central Valley to pollinate almonds this year because their colonies were so decimated. If this is true, I just hate that news. That's terrible. Now, interestingly enough, tonight I had a conversation with Stan Wazitowski, who is in Florida and coming back very soon. And he had lunch with Dave Hackenberg the other day. And I asked him if Dave mentioned any of this. I would think if this is true, that in the beekeepers' discussion, this idea would surface. And Stan said, nope, didn't come up. So I have to wonder, I'm not doubting the reporting here, but I have to wonder what the story is behind of this. I spoke to Stan and said maybe he could bring this up with somebody else, another well-known beekeeper who's been in movies that he's about to go see, and ask him if he knows anything of reports of big problems going on down there in Florida. And I'll be curious to talk to him in April when he comes back up and hear what the follow-up was. There's been a lot of conversation, and I've mentioned it, that bees are out pollinating. This is about the time they leave in January, and they head out for this time of year to pollinate almonds before they're moved over to the Midwest to put on clover and then taken throughout the rest of the country for various pollinating contracts. And you have to wonder what the story is for the amount of bees out there in California this year, especially if 90% of the bees are lost there in Hackenberg's operation. What keeps everybody else from being immune to that? So anyway, just an interesting curiosity about what has happened here. And hopefully this is not something that's going on in a widespread sense. Incidentally, it should be noted that in that same article, it says Brett Adi, the biggest beekeeper in the world, also recently lost a massive amount of hives. He went from 90,000 hives to 40,000. And it shouts out that this is not the first time Brett has lost a big part of his operation. So, wow, can you imagine what it's like trying to be a commercial operator? And I know a couple guys that are commercial in scope. I'm curious when I run across them to ask them what they know about this, and we'll see if I can get a follow-up from everybody to find out what the backstory is on some of this. But not good news in the beekeeping commercial space, for sure. Moving on to roundtable number 4. Had 3 types of hives I wanted to talk about that I've come across recently. These are unique designs and or older designs that are making some news, and I'll explain why. The first one is a cathedral hive. This was presented as an idea from Roger Gares, who was at our meeting recently here in February, and he's making one of these. It looks like a conventional top bar, but if you can picture the top bar hive with its slanted sides and a flat bottom, make 2 of those and put one on top of the other, and you have a 6-sided shape, and the frames are angled in the bottom like a conventional top, but they're also angled in the top, and they form a 6-sided frame for the bees to build on. And the interesting thing about this frame is it's tapered across the top and the bottom, and it has holes through the top of the frame. And the premise of this is, if you think about a six-sided design stacked like coins next to each other in slots, and the bees build the entire face with comb from the top to the bottom and close the entire piece, how do the bees move horizontally through a horizontal hive? The idea is to give them holes across the top of the frames. And mind you, the frames are tapered, so they're not flat-sided, so that when you put one frame next to the other, there's no place to get out. They're tapered, they're angled, so they make an upside-down V-shape when they're set next to each other. And they can go through the frame hole and then come out the bottom of the V and go down to the comb below. So the reason I thought this was interesting is, one, the shape is interesting, the way it works. It's like a bunch of different discs stacked next to each other. And the other thing is these holes. We've talked about this in the past a long time ago, where sometimes you'll find in frames, the upper corners through the middle, the lower corners, there's a hole in your frame. They don't build it all the way out, where they literally chew. And you might see it, if you're observant enough, you'll see these holes through several frames. This is the bee's secret tunnel. Instead of having to walk all the way up the frame, over the top, and back down to get to the other side, they just chew a hole and go through. It's like the express lane for the hive to go back through. If you've never seen this, open your hive in the spring and look at some of your comb and see if you recognize holes that run horizontally through the face of the combs, and you'll know that's what that is. So backyardhive.com is where you could find a link to the Cathedral Hive, the next evolution in the top bar hive design. The next hive I wanted to talk about was the Dartington Hive. Someone at our beekeepers meeting here in February was talking about building a hive that is like a top bar but has flat sides. And the premise of this would be able to, it would be able to hold a conventional Langstroth hive. And what we mentioned during the conversation from myself and the crowd, I was presenting at the time, is that this is not a new notion. In fact, a lot of different beekeepers have come up with this design. And what they do is they build what some refer to as a coffin hive. Sometimes these were referred to as Tanzania-style hives. Sometimes they're just extended Langstroth hives, but they run horizontal, not vertical. Now, what's unique about the Dartington hive, and similar to the top bar hive that I built, that I've been trying for two seasons to get going, is that it has dimensions, so the brood box is larger than both national and Langstroth beehives, and it gives the bee colony freedom to grow without restriction. They can go horizontally as big as they want, but the supers that you put on top, ding, 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 are half the size of a conventional super. So the way this works is you have a full square shape, top bar style hive on the bottom, and it's measured long enough that you can put conventional honey supers on top, and then the roof sits on top of that. And so the bottom becomes the brood chamber, and the top becomes the honey dome, and you could put your boxes on and harvest your honey. My particular box that I have out in the yard has tapered sides like a conventional top bar, but the top dimensions fit a Langstroth frame. And I'm using the Kelly frame that's used with the V-shape underneath. I forget what style it is. You could find it in their catalog. And I am literally allowing the bees to pass through that. And they can come up into the honey boxes. I could fit three mediums over top the length of my hive. And so hopefully when I start my package and then replace the queen and get this thing going, I could potentially get some honey boxes out of this. So the Dartington hive is from 1975. It was designed by engineer Robin Dartington. And it had some unique features. But one of the coolest one was the legs on this thing. So the legs are on a pivot, and they splay out to hold the hive up at the right height so that you can operate it. But when you want to move the, you take the legs and pull them out, and you, they come out and they become like a wheelbarrow handle on both ends. And two people can carry this hive and put it in a truck using the legs. So you have to check this out. I'll have a link in my show notes to this. It's a pretty cool design back from 1975. And the fact of the matter is you could still buy these. I've seen links in, let's say in the UK, there's a website called thorn.co.uk. And they sell Dartington hives to this day. And I'm guessing you could buy plans to build these and do whatever. So that's of interest. You can. How cool is that? So the next one, one more to go. This is the Slovenia style AZ hive. I've mentioned this in past podcasts. I wanted to build a hive that works on a cartridge concept. No lifting boxes. Swing the door open, grab the end of the frame, and slide it out. Look at it and slide it back in like a cartridge. I have a couple prototype designs that I'm working on, but someone mentioned in a YouTube post for alternative hives, Susan Gallien, G-A-L-L-I-E-N, thank you if you're listening, that these Slovenian-style AZ hives work this way. So we watched a video last year, and I'll be darned if I could remember, Valley of the Sun or something like that, and it showed beekeepers in Switzerland who had this big house-like thing with a bunch of boxes lined up next to each other, and they would open the back and they would slide the cartridge out, slide the frame out, and then slide it back in. That's what this hive looks like. If you've ever seen the video, they're smoking cigars and they don't use a smoker. They take a couple puffs, men and women, by the way, and they smoke the hive by using the cigars. I thought that was kind of neat. So again, I'll post a video to what a hive looks like. It's neat. I thought that was neat, and I really appreciate the person listening and sharing that back across. We've made our way to roundtable number 5, getting the healthy benefits of honey. Talked about this on or off, on and off during the podcast. And it made the commentary about medical professionals indicate that honey is not going to solve your problems when you eat it. And I saw this on Facebook, so it has to be true. The antibacterial properties of honey are poorly manifested upon consumption. Why? That's an interesting question. So part of the beneficial side of honey is its antimicrobial activities. And quite simply, this says gastric and duodenal juices significantly neutralize antimicrobial activity. So there it is, folks. As we thought, the beneficial side of honey does not survive, according to this article on Facebook, so it has to be true. The gastric juices. Now, I've heard this before, and the question is, how can it be used practically? And what they say is, if you make a tincture out of some of these things by mixing it with alcohol, or you apply it straight up, two different areas, you may possibly be able to take advantage of it. So most folk medicine and references indicate that you apply it to the exterior of your body. However, if you think about sublingual applications, it could potentially be the way to get it into yourself. So sublingual, what does that mean? Lingual is language or tongue, and sublingual means put it underneath your tongue. The article suggests crystallized honey is suitable for that purpose because it lingers and it melts there. And hopefully the antimicrobial things will manifest themselves in your mouth and possibly absorbed through the tissues underneath your tongue into your bloodstream. And that method of administration is something that's been used for eons, sublingual. Nitroglycerin, when people take it for heart problems, taken sublingually under the tongue. Vitamin B12, if you're not getting enough, you can buy it sublingually under the tongue. So that's pretty cool. Now, you could put this stuff in your gastrointestinal tract, and maybe it's going to introduce microbes that weren't there. Who knows? I think the antibacterial effects are well known. And one of the byproducts of decomposing honey is hydrogen peroxide, which creates something that kills bad bugs. And also because honey has a high sugar content, it hinders the growth of microbes in there because it can't survive in that environment. So I'm not going to belabor the point, just wanted to point out the sublingual thing. I thought that was new information about this. And I think that's pretty interesting. So if you're looking for the benefits of it, don't just swallow it down. Swish it around inside your mouth and put it underneath your tongue, and you might get more out of your mileage. More mileage. So I'm usually game for a couple more, but given that it's a Monday night and I'm recording, I think I'm going to call it. It's been a long day. I'm going to call it a night. I'm recording on a Monday night because I felt guilty because I haven't put out a podcast in a couple weeks and wanted to get something out here for you. I should note that I've been busy last weekend. I would have really liked to have done the podcast, but we had a beekeepers meeting for our association. I made lip balm live. That went very well. We did a honey tasting, thanks to Jim McCauley and others who brought honey for tasting. Tupelo, sourwood, linden, and others. 6, 7, 8 different varieties. It's really, really cool. If you haven't had a chance to do that, that's a lot of fun. And we covered a two-queen system. I put together a presentation a long time ago. We were supposed to do this meeting in the beginning of January, and it got postponed 2 or 3 times. And somebody came to me this week and said, incidentally, that this was being covered in Bee Culture magazine, so that's cool. Anyway, it was a great meeting. I mentioned that at the opening, and that's how I'll end. I really had a good time with that. A lot of new beekeepers at this meeting, so that's pretty exciting. And I'm hearing from our membership committee that we have a lot of new members this year. Have several things coming up. Meetings. March 19th, we're doing a meeting where we're doing brunch and a movie. And we're going to do honey recipes for Northwest New Jersey. If you're coming, bring something made with honey. I've said this before. Well, that's the meeting. I keep testing all these recipes. And speaking of that, I mentioned earlier you can go to Northwest New Jersey's YouTube channel. The Honey Bites is up there, the Honey Almond, and the Lip Balm videos that I've made over the last couple weeks are in there, along with some information about the paste waxes that I talked about recently. So, two other meetings coming up. April 15th, 16th, I don't remember the date, whatever that Saturday is, we'll have our first field meeting, where we'll be over at the Mentoring Hives. We're going to install 2 packages that day and go over a couple things, along with other spring preparations. And then the following weekend is the New Jersey Beekeepers Association spring meeting, which our association is hosting. I've mentioned this before. Now we're starting to firm things up. Judy Chen from the USDA lab in Beltsville will be the featured speaker. Dr. David Gilley from William Patterson University will also be speaking that day, and we're planning a number of activities. And if you didn't get to see me make lip balm, we're probably going to do it there at that meeting again. We did the dry run and it worked out really well, so we're excited to try that again. And we posted all of our meetings for Northwest coming up through the rest of the year, actually. It's going to be a really busy schedule. And as I think about that, I am currently in the throes over the last couple weekends of remodeling a bathroom at the house. It's been a long time coming. I'm going to strip it down to the studs and rebuild it with all the good new stuff. I'm very excited about that, and I've spent the last couple weekends out shopping and getting things prepped for that. But I've also been doing beekeeping activities. So I'm currently prepping a video that I'll post out on our YouTube of a hive, swarm, bait hive, whatever you want to call this thing, jib that I made. I've mentioned this before, I think, on the podcast. It was something I found in the Bee Culture magazine. And Jim Schmalz down the road and I put up our hive traps with these, and you'll be able to see it in operation. It's not a complicated device. It's 2 8-foot long 2x4s bound together where they join to make a 16-foot pole. And at the end, you have this template that'll lean against a tree, and you put a couple, what do they call them? Drawing a blank? Pulleys. Duh, with some rope, and it allows you to hoist your hive up. It sure beats trying to carry a box up a ladder and secure it to a tree. That's just not the way to go. And it's especially not the way to go when you're trying to lower it. Now, Sealy says if you want to be successful with traps, you put them out now and you put them up high in the tree. This thing gets the job done on both accounts. So I'm also planning a vacation and EAS conference attendance this year in July. And it looks like I'm heading out to India again for work for a week sometime, possibly in June. It was supposed to be May, but it's being postponed now. So there's certainly a good number of activities coming up. But I promise you, I will make every opportunity to get in behind the microphone. Actually, I have a series of interviews with a bunch of different guests for the website or for the podcast lined up, and I'm really looking forward. I know I'm going to click a couple of those off, so you won't have to suffer with listening to me behind rambling like I am right now. But I'll be in there mixing and telling you what's going on here in spring, and hopefully my video camera will come back. Still haven't heard about that. And I'll be able to shoot some spring videos and get things going. So anyway, no rest for the weary. And given where we sit from time, I think it's time to wrap it up. Again, if you have anything interesting to share, kevin@bkcorner is the email address. I'd be happy to hear from you. Just let me know how things are going. If you do write in, please let me know how to pronounce your name and where you're contacting me from. And I do appreciate everybody that writes in. And I also appreciate the iTunes exposure. It really does help people find us when you give us reviews, as more reviews get us higher in the rankings there. One last thing is I have received a couple donations. And again, I do appreciate any donation that we receive. There's a link to PayPal on our website. And I always put those to good use in producing the podcast. So on that note, we appreciate you stopping by. Look forward to catching up with you on the next episode. But before we leave, we'll say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.